Well, I'm delighted to introduce to you Professor Jutta Schwarzkopf. She teaches British Studies at Bielefeld University, Germany. She's published very widely in the fields of British social and cultural studies and also gender studies. Her publications include Gendering, Exploitation, The Use of Gender in the Campaign Against Driving in Lancashire Weaving Sheds, 1886 to 1903, in Women's History in 1998, Gender and Technology, Inverted Established Patterns, The Lancashire Cotton Weaving Industry at the Start of the 20th Century, in Margaret Walsh's edited volume, Working Out Gender, published in 1999, and Unpicking Gender, Gender and the Lancashire Cotton Weaving Industry, 1914. Her paper today forms part of a wider project on the social construction of gender in the Lancashire cotton industry and is entitled Deriving Satisfaction from Work in a Period of Increasing International Competition, Skill as the Linchpin of Lancashire Women Weavers' Identity. And I hand you over to Jutta.
Right, thank you very much for your very kind introduction. Now, my paper will consider the Lancashire cotton weaving industry in a particular period, lasting from roughly the mid-1870s to 1914, and the focus of my paper will be on the identity the large number of female weavers fashioned for themselves and for which conditions on the shop floor were crucial. Now, the argument I'm going to make is going to move through several stages. I shall start off with a very, very brief overview of the development of the cotton weaving industry, simply to highlight what was specific about the period that forms the focus of my paper. I shall then go on to consider the weaving workforce among the women weavers in particular, of course. So I shall look at the gender composition of the weaving workforce. I shall look at the method of pay, which is of crucial importance, as you'll see. I shall then turn to the level of skill involved in weaving, and then focus on women weavers' identity construction. And finally, consider how women weavers' identity the repercussions of women weavers' identity construction on gender relations in weaving families. Okay, now, to begin with a brief survey of the industry's development. Cotton processing not only pioneered industrialisation in Britain, but up until the First World War, the industry also remained one of the major contributors to national wealth. Domestic textile production had been expanding rapidly on the basis of the putting out system when, in the 1770s, spinning was mechanised and transferred to factories, where it was followed by weaving some decades later. Thus began the industry's era of expansion, which comprised three distinct periods, each of which was characterised by successively slower rates of increase in production, and which ended in 1840, 1872, and 1913, respectively. The mechanisation of spinning and weaving, along with the preparatory processes, spanned the period from the 1780s to the 1840s, during which the industry's growth rate peaked because the power-driven machines rendered English cotton cloth cheap without lowering its quality. During the subsequent phase, from the 1840s to the 1870s, the industry took on its typically modern form in terms of organisation and technology. Both were to survive fundamentally unchanged until the Second World War. This phase was characterised by unparalleled prosperity based on supremacy in overseas markets. The commercial crisis of 1873 ushered in the next phase, often dubbed the Indian Summer by historians of the cotton industry. This phase was to last until the beginning of the First World War. By the 1870s, the industry's global supremacy began to be challenged. The greatest threat was posed not so much by competition from other industrial economies, but by the beginning industrialization of former importers of British cotton goods. As a result, exports went increasingly to less developed economies with lower income and greater demand for coarser yarn and cloth, such as India. In these markets, the British cotton industry managed to remain competitive by reducing the quality of the cotton input at each stage of the production process. The technology in use, the self-acting spinning mule, and the power loom were particularly suited to producing this type of goods. At the same time, higher quality cloth aimed at the domestic and European markets continued to be produced. In combination, both types of goods enabled the industry to retain its export markets as prerequisite of expansion in terms of output, consumption of raw cotton, and labour force. The rise in volume of production at the same time that value declined reflected the increase in exports of cheap varieties of cloth. Output of yarn and cloth more than doubled between 1870 and 1913, the latter year marking the highest point ever achieved. Yet hidden beneath the growth and volume attained by the industry in that period lay relative decline. The rate of growth increased but little, and the proportion of people employed in cotton processing declined, as did Britain's share of the world's output. This became fully apparent after the end of the First World War. Okay. Ha! Now we see. I think you need to be extremely sharp-sighted to see the detail, but I think it'll do for my purposes. Over time, cotton processing became increasingly concentrated in Lancashire and the adjoining fringes of Cheshire and Derbyshire. So, hang on. Where's my little red point? Oh, it doesn't show on the screen. Doesn't matter. I'd be happy to take a little walk. Okay, so this is obviously Lancashire with the cotton towns clearly marked, and you see some of them actually on the fringes of Cheshire and Derbyshire. I mean, if you look at Stockport, for instance, which today forms part of Greater Manchester, strictly speaking, was Cheshire at the time. So this is where cotton processing was concentrated, and what I'm going to say in a few moments is that over time they developed increasing regional specialisation. So you have spinning chiefly concentrated in a kind of semicircle around Manchester. This is Manchester, so you have it concentrated in a semicircle around Manchester, whereas weaving was chiefly clustered in the north and northeast of the county, in the Burnley, Nelson, Cone, and Blackburn, Accrington, Durham, Blackburn, Accrington area or region, sort of around here. So a clear geographical segregation or separation, if you like. Okay. By 1911, Lancashire employed nearly 90% of the industry's workforce, just going to show how much cotton processing had become concentrated in Lancashire. Within the county, cotton processing was geographically segregated, with spinning predominating in the semicircle around Manchester, while mechanised weaving chiefly clustered in the northeast and north of Lancashire, particularly in the Burnley, Nelson, Cone and Blackburn, Durham, Accrington areas, the areas I've just pointed out to you. By the closing decades of the 19th century, the British cotton industry had come to be characterised by a high degree of regional concentration, coupled with a marked diversity of local specialisation. Linked to this was a specific internal structure, with vertical integration of spinning and weaving being the exception. Process specialisation was encouraged as the range of products increased. Each type of cloth required a particular count of yarn, which was available at lower costs in the competitive open market than from the spinning department of a combined mill. Apart from being largely distinct geographically, cotton spinning and weaving were internally subdivided in that virtually each district specialised in a class of goods of its own. In weaving, the western towns, Bolton, Chorley and Preston, specialised in fine, high-quality cloth, as did parts of south-east Lancashire, such as Ashton. Trade in the easterly towns, Oldham, Blackburn and Burnley, was geared to coarse cloth. Let me now consider the people employed in the Lancashire weaving sheds. And here, I should show you a picture of a typical weaving shed, which is easily recognisable by the so-called sawtooth roof it had. So these are all single-storey buildings, because unlike in spinning, where you get a lot of multi-storey factories, the weight of the machinery was far too great, for multi-storey buildings to be able to take the weight. So they are single-storey buildings, and they've all got these sawtooth roof, which is due to, north-facing windows letting in sufficient light. Okay. The early factories had been staffed predominantly by women and children, while men clung to the increasingly elusive independence of handloom weaving. When the resistance to factory work collapsed in the 1840s, women still retained their preponderance, which even increased slightly over the second half of the 19th century. Around 1900, women formed more than 60% of the weaving workforce. Among the large number of women, the proportion of wives was far in excess of the national average of wives in paid employment outside the home. Many of them must be presumed to have been mothers of small children. Due to the nature of the data available, this can only be inferred from the age groups of the women employed in weaving, but it cannot be quantified. The rules governing pay, which I'm now turning to, makes the Lancashire cotton weaving industry unique. Weavers' pay was regulated by price lists, which laid down in minute detail the amount of money due for each exactly specified type of cloth. Importantly, piece rates differed according to the class of goods produced, but not by gender. When in the mid-1840s men began to join women and children in the weaving sheds in large numbers, non-gender-related piece rates were the means to ensure that employers would not give precedence in employment to women over men. As a result, women weavers counted among the highest paid groups of female workers in Britain. Female weavers themselves felt sufficiently strongly about their right to equal rates repeatedly to take strike action over this issue, thereby gaining a reputation for insisting on being treated equally with regard to rates of pay. Conversely, male weavers were working for a woman's wage. As a result, no weaving family was able to subsist on one adult income alone. Non-gender-related piece rates did not translate into uniform levels of weekly pay, which was influenced by a number of variables: the number of looms operated, the type of cloth woven, the ability to adjust one's own loom so as to avoid machine downtime while waiting for the overlooker, and last but not least, the individual degree of skill. As a result of the differential effect of these variables in any one week, weavers' weekly earnings were subject to marked fluctuation. In the heartland of cotton weaving, where the industry virtually monopolised local labour markets, women found themselves working side by side with men, operating the same type and frequently also the same number of looms for which they were paid equal rates. Depending on the individual level of skill, it was perfectly possible for a female weaver in any one week to earn the same, if not more, than her male counterpart, and that despite the steady deterioration of the conditions of work. Okay, now this is obviously a photograph taken inside a weaving shed. I've included it in my PowerPoint presentation, but I don't actually like it very much because it looks to me very much as though the women have come forward to kind of pose for the photograph. And this is why I like this one much better, because it does appear to show workers actually working, and you see men as well as women attending to their looms. In the increasingly competitive environment in which the Lancashire weaving industry was operating, From the closing decades of the 19th century onwards, economic viability hinged upon the skill and efficiency of the industry's workforce. Relying on well-tried technology, the weavers of Lancashire were able to produce cloth more cheaply than its newly arisen rivals, and goods of higher quality than its continental and US competitors, despite manufacturers' increasing resort to cost-saving inferior raw material at the same time that machinery was speeded up. The ability to produce good quality cloth nonetheless testifies to the level of skill weavers possessed. This throws up the question of the skill content of weaving, which I'm going to examine now. Let me begin with a few general observations. Skill is anything but an objective category characterising the requirements of a particular labour process. More appropriately, skill must be seen as the result of the interplay of requirements based in the labour process, social construction, and the relations of power between labour and capital in a given trade. Social construction is not confined to what Turner has shown, the ability of strong trade unions effectively to control entry into their trade, thus driving up wages for labour that is in scarce supply. Gender too has an important bearing on which jobs are classified as skilled, with many male jobs uncritically being equated with skilled work, simply because they're carried out by men. Cotton processing is a case in point. Mule spinning, which was a male preserve and well paid, was considered skilled, while weaving, carried out by large numbers of women, was seen as semi-skilled. On closer inspection, however, it becomes apparent that all the elements on which rested spinners' claim to skill, such as authority over helpers, the requirements imposed by the highly variable character of both the material and the machinery involved in the job, were present in weaving as well. Moreover, Lancashire cotton operatives, precisely because they looked back upon the longest tradition of mechanisation in the country, had been socialised into factory work over several generations, thus boasting a high level of what Maxine Bird has termed factory skills, that is, workers' ability to reproduce a limited number of operations accurately and speedily. Though not specifically related to the job in hand, these skills were indispensable for the smooth running of production. In addition, weavers required specific skills which were to do with the nature of both the material and the machinery they were dealing with. As a natural product, which is subject to nearly infinite variation, cotton requires a high degree of experience-based knowledge and ability to be processed. What's more, the many variables having an impact on cotton processing render it impossible clearly to specify each stage of the process. Furthermore, there is a large number of types of cloth that cotton can be woven into, and which place varying degrees of strain on the yarn used. Ideally, the quality of the yarn should improve in proportion to the quality of cloth desired. Yet in order to cut down on production costs in the face of stiffening competition from abroad, as noted above, manufacturers resorted to inferior primary products without reducing the requirements on the quality of the end product, relying on the worker's skill to compensate for any deficiencies of the material supplied. In weaving, the technical difficulties and hence the demands made on worker's skill increased from the production of plain, coarse cloths through fine cloths to those with complicated patterns and mixed warps. It is significant that those places specialising in the production of high-quality goods, such as Preston, Bolton and Chorley, also have the largest proportion of females among the weaving workforce. In these towns, local labour markets offered well-paid alternative employment for men. However, the large number of women weavers did not lead to the substitution of high-quality goods by those of lesser quality. Finally, the machines too have their peculiarities, because Victorian machines were tailor-made rather than mass-produced. Looms were neither very sophisticated nor working at optimum efficiency. Hence, it was up to the weaver to obtain the best possible results from a deficient machine by constantly readjusting it to the job in hand. Accordingly, to be mechanically minded among weavers meant to know one's looms. There were no two looms that were identical to each other. This is why weavers held on to their particular loom complement. Familiarity with one set of machines was not likely to trade it in for a different one, where the weavers would have to start from scratch trying to discover their peculiarities. The level of skill attained by the individual worker had a bearing on the way they perceived conditions at work. Those who had failed fully to master the trade found weaving extremely laborious, the exertion required being exacerbated by the heat and often the humidity that filled the atmosphere in the mill. Furthermore, the incentive to drive themselves hard, held out by payment by the piece, was significantly added to by the pressure to maximise output exerted by overlookers. Despite the worsening of working conditions, competent weavers, by contrast, derived pleasure from doing their job and doing it well. They enjoyed watching the pattern form in the cloth being woven and expressed a strong preference for fancy over plain weaving. Making more demands on their skill, it rendered their job more interesting. Acquiring the level of skill that made a competent weaver took time. Implanting in their daughters' minds the wish to become a weaver was an important objective working-class parents in the cotton weaving district aimed at in the upbringing of their female offspring. Practical preparation for factory work, rather than any encouragement to look forward to a life of domesticity, was part and parcel of girls' preparation for adulthood. By the time youngsters entered the mill as half-timers in their early teens, they would already be familiar with most aspects of the labour process, including the people they were likely to encounter on the shop floor, many of whom would be kin or neighbours. Skill in weaving was not acquired in the course of a formal apprenticeship, but through training on the job, by being assigned to an experienced weaver. The initial stage of learner lasted for a few weeks. Learning consisted mainly in closely observing the experienced worker, with only the piecing of broken threads being actually taught. Once they've mastered certain basic skills, which the more talented ones managed in as little as 3 months, learners were promoted to tenters, or weaver's assistants, and began to receive wages. This was a time wage paid out of the earnings of the weaver for whom they worked. Although the weaver tenter diet need not be gender homogeneous, many girls were initiated into the art of weaving by mothers, aunts, or other female relatives. The transmission of skill thus often occurred along the female line of a family. The job of the instructor was not confined to teaching the tenter the skills of the trade. Apart from sharing with a mother in the upbringing of the learner, the job comprised teaching shop floor mores, such as the employee's duty vis-à-vis the employer, and ways of seeking redress in cases of unfair treatment by involving the union. After about 2 years, a tenter could count on being allocated the first 2 looms of her or his own. With promotion to a set of looms of one's own began a new stage in the aspiring weaver's career, the corresponding rise in wages marking the passage to adulthood. Over time and with experience gained, the number of looms allocated to an individual weaver increased, until after about 6 to 7 years, 4 looms were mastered. Mastery was not confined to the production of faultless cloth, but extended to the mechanical workings of the loom. Although tackling was a masculine preserve, women could not help but discover from extensive experience how the looms at which they spent their days were operating. This is why many of them were able to carry out repairs and tune the machines themselves. Moreover, there was a strong incentive for doing so, because it helped reduce pay cuts through keeping machine downtime low. It also made for some measure of independence of tacklers, who, in a blatant display of power, liked to keep the weavers waiting. Awareness of their competence at work was the linchpin of weavers' identity, to which I will now turn. Oral testimony makes abundantly clear that women weavers' self-esteem and pride were intimately linked to the skill involved in their job, about which they spoke with a fluency and confidence that testifies both to their expertise in the industrial processes they describe and the familiarity with formal relations of employment. Oblivious to the low esteem in which weaving was held by outsiders, female weavers consistently spoke of themselves as skilled workers having mastered a trade, thereby laying claim to attributes usually associated with masculinity. They deployed them to fashion for themselves an identity of women workers whose competent tending of machines and whose ability to produce faultless cloth formed the prerequisites of a desired level of pay. Acutely aware of the significance of their earnings to family income, they were quick to draw the analogy between themselves and male workers who laid claim to a respectable lifestyle on the basis of skill. Women weavers' personal testimonies represent a process of discursive self-determination in a double sense. Not only did they divest certain concepts of their gender specificity by appropriating as feminine what was usually thought of as masculine, they also subverted the gender discourse of the labour movement, in which the housebound working class woman was ubiquitous, by constructing for themselves the identity of skilled workers whose competence was equal to men's, as the weekly earnings testified. Their self-representation, strikingly deviant from the dominant understanding of working-class femininity, was embedded in and derived its acceptability from the cultural values shared by the weaving communities of which the women formed part. These were characterized by a marked degree of homogeneity due to the bulk of the population working in the local mills and neighborhood and shop floor largely overlapping in terms of personnel. Thus, neither the high labour participation rate of women nor the large proportion of wives and mothers among them was perceived as something out of the ordinary. The centrality of skill to female weavers' identity is further corroborated by the disconcertingly large number of young female weavers committing suicide, typically by drowning themselves in the mill pond, at precisely that point in their career when they should have moved on to a pair of looms of their own, but lacked the competence to do so. The suicides were desperate acts committed by women who had given up all hope of ever establishing a reputation for being skilled workers. Failure to develop this quality, as the suicides dramatised convincingly, was tantamount to failure in terms of personal development. Precisely because women weavers' identity revolved largely around their jobs, failure to achieve such a level of competence undermined these women's self-confidence and self-esteem. Lacking the opportunity of establishing themselves in an occupation as skilled and well-paid as weaving, some of them saw no alternative to committing suicide. It was the availability of such alternative employment to men which acted as a buffer against the effects on male weavers of driving them to achieve more output. In fact, a man could not but enhance his reputation as a worker by leaving the predominantly female job of weaving. For women, by contrast, failure to become an expert weaver brought in its wake severe losses, not only in financial terms, but also in terms of personal development. In fact, the two were inseparable. The more a woman excelled at weaving, the better her income, the higher her standing in the local community, and the greater her personal satisfaction. The factory-based organisation of weaving assembled in one place a large number of women spending a great deal of time in each other's company. Their proximity was ambiguous in that it facilitated social control as well as female bonding, the source of strength when taking collective action. Shop floor mores were enforced by group pressure. Keeping to oneself in order to maximise one's output was frowned upon, and any attempt to disown a faulty cut attributing to attributing it to another weaver so as to evade a fine, was quashed by close group supervision. Female bonding, by contrast, underscored by the centrality accorded by weavers to paid work, becomes apparent in something approaching a female work culture, which revolved around female solidarity inside and outside the mill. The notion of work culture implies the possibility of a relatively autonomous sphere of action on the job that workers create as they distance themselves from the structure of production and the authority of employers. Festive occasions are a case in point. Everyone joined in celebrating Christmas and birthdays. Then workers would give themselves special treats, the expense for which was shared. Weddings were accorded special relevance, marking as they did a status passage in the female life cycle, with significant repercussions on the way the women's wages would be spent in future. When a co-worker was about to get married, weekly collections of money were made to buy a present and to meet the expenses of the footing that was expected on such an occasion. Everyone would be regaled with special food and drink, including alcohol, consumption of which on milk premises was usually prohibited. Yet in recognition of the special occasion, this prohibition, as well as Tapler's authority, were waived, the men retiring from the scene of the party. These occasions testify to the strength women derived from their large number. This enabled them to force management to back off from any interference in their celebrations of what they considered turning points in the female life cycle. Furthermore, these occasions bear witness to women weavers' ability to reclaim work time and factory space for uses of their own, frustrating any attempt on the employer's part fully to regiment the female workforce. Finally, the organisation of such informal activities focusing on the female life cycle and the manifold ways in which women discursively brought their families to work by discussing familial problems with co-workers acted as strong bonding devices among groups of female weavers, empowering them to resist. For the women staging them, these celebrations were a means of proclaiming the specific way work and family meshed in their lives. Importantly, an event of great significance in their private lives, like a wedding, which, however, was not tantamount to abandoning factory work, was celebrated at the workplace. True, this was also to do with a high degree of overlap between co-workers, friends and family, but the fact remains that women brought their private lives to the workplace rather than vice versa. The fact that they were able to do so openly rather than surreptitiously testifies to the acknowledgement of this interconnection on the part of management. They appear to have valued women as workers too much even to attempt to frustrate their desire to demonstrate that life is not all work but also play, including at the workplace. Women took pride in their ability to make an important contribution to family income on the basis of their competence at work. This, combined with the satisfaction derived from performing a complicated job well and the delight they took in mixing with other women on the shop floor, made for the attraction of working in the mill and accounts for the sizeable number of women who stayed on well after their children began to contribute to family income. Women weavers were not the downtrodden victims suffering from double subordination by industrial capitalism and male hegemony. Proud of their work-based skills and counting on the support from female co-workers, they held their own both against the dictates of economic exploitation and the impact of male dominance. What helped them fight exploitation was the high degree of unionisation, and here I've chosen a trade union banner. This is the trade union banner of the Blackburn Weavers, Winders and Warpers Association, and obviously I've picked it because it depicts a woman weaver. Yeah, and in that it is quite extraordinary. So what helped them fight exploitation was the high degree of unionisation, as well as the marked degree of militancy, which made women weavers stand out nationally. For many of them, starting work in the mill and joining the union were one and the same. not least because it was part of the initiation into factory work by elder relatives. Resorting to trade union assistance as a matter of course, be it by having their payslips checked or be it to complain about overbearing tacklers, women weavers had the satisfaction of having their concerns taken seriously. By contrast, unions were no help in promoting women's gender-specific concerns, such as the suffrage. Weavers' unions, though boasting large numbers of female members at grassroots level, were male-dominated organisations because union officialdom was jealously guarded as a male preserve. The Lancashire cotton weaving industry was characterised by a large proportion of females among its workforce, many of whom spent a sizeable portion of their lifetime toiling in the mill, starting in their early teens and continuing well after getting married and having a family. True, married women's factory employment was necessitated by the inadequacy of male weavers' wages for the support of a family. Hence, the notion of a male breadwinning wage had no currency in weaving communities. Instead, wives were expected, as a matter of course, to contribute what amounted to about half the family income, at least until their share was made up for by children's wages. This points to a specific understanding of gender peculiar to the cotton weaving district of Lancashire, which I'm now turning to. There had evolved understandings of gender that stood in marked contrast to the labour movement's discourse on the male breadwinner and his complement, the domestic housewife. In the heartland of cotton weaving, masculinity did not revolve around the performance of work deemed skilled and the attendant ability to earn a family wage. Conversely, femininity was not characterised by domesticity. Rather, it centred on paid work carried out away from home even after marriage and on a degree of competence in weaving that enabled women to bring home a pay packet matching and potentially even exceeding that of a male weaver. These notions of gender were bound to make an impact on relations of power in the family. One way in which female weavers managed to combine full-time factory work with care for household and children consisted in delegating household chores for payment of cash. Thus, they paid non-factory women for services such as childminding and washing, as well as relying on ready-made meals and clothes. Female weavers knew only too well the difference their wages made to family income. Yet there was more at stake than mere economic calculation. Delegating housework was also a matter of inclination. These women saw themselves first and foremost as wage workers and only secondly as wives and mothers. As their oral testimony shows, their memories revolved around and were temporally anchored in the paid work in the mill, while family events and housewifery in particular faded into the background. When recounting their lives, they used changes of workplace or promotion as a time grid temporally to locate the events of their lives. Delegation of household chores for cash was subject to the variations in weavers' income and never complete. Like other working class women, cotton weavers relied on the help of their children, predominantly their daughters, but significantly also on their husband's assistance. In this respect, female weavers' husbands differed markedly from the majority of the working class contemporaries. Men's participation in housework was so much accepted and taken for granted that it passed into regional folklore. Marianne was the nickname for men who could actually be seen doing housework without, however, suffering any damage to their masculinity. Marianne Knight was the particular evening in the week when men would customarily do jobs about the house. Women themselves shared in the community belief that weaving wives were not only deserved, but were actually entitled to be helped by their husbands, not least because the latter too benefited from the extra income generated by their wives' factory labour. Men's willingness to share in the housework and the extent of their assistance were shaped, though not determined, by their wives' employment away from home. While some ceased doing household jobs when the wives abandoned millwork, others carried on regardless. Weaver's husbands relinquished a number of mainstays of male dominance, apart from taking over tasks commonly seen as feminine. They usually tipped up their wages, leaving their wives to manage the couple's pooled earnings. Although this custom was not confined to Lancashire, female weavers took charge of managing the family exchequer by right and not by concession on their husband's part. The openly acknowledged absence of a male breadwinner wage and the concomitant need for wives to earn an income militated against both any sharp gender division of familial roles with a husband as provider and the wife as the home manager, and against the marital tension frequently erupting in violence, resulting from either partner's failure to live up to the respective ideal. As a result, male violence was not condoned by the norms of the weaving community. Moreover, weaving couples shared not only the responsibilities of supporting a family, as well as domestic chores, but also leisure pursuits. This became perhaps most obvious in the mass exodus of entire families from the cotton district to the seaside resort of Blackpool in the summer. The picture that emerges of female weavers' families, and of weaving couples in particular, is one of a degree of overlap in the experience of husbands and wives which was more pronounced than among other working class couples. Due to actually carrying out identical work, these men and women knew the ins and outs of each other's jobs, which precluded both any denigration of female labour and the shrouding of male jobs in any kind of mystery. Couples may even have been employed at the same mill, or may at least have met for being co-workers. The similarity of work experience was underpinned by the negligible or non-existent difference in the amount of wages each of them brought home. Coupled with the indispensability of the wife's earnings to family income, this enabled female weavers to be sparing of services for husbands, who in turn were unable to enforce such services because they could lay no claim to being chief earners. A most important way of making family needs compatible with full-time employment, while also preserving women's physical well-being, consisted in limiting the number of children. Significantly, this also involved a major shift in weavers' masculinity, away from the centrality of the capacity to inseminate. In the cotton weaving industry, the abundance of juvenile labour, the deployment of which was controlled and hence institutionalised by the early factory acts, made for juvenile earnings which were significantly lower than those of either parent. It therefore made most sense economically for couples to arrange their childbearing so as to maximise both spouses' ability to earn, or at least to have so many children so quickly that the wife was forced to abandon factory work before the first child reached teenage earning capacity. Achievement of this goal hinged on husbands' cooperation. It is the joint decision-making process required in this endeavour which highlights the more egalitarian relations between husbands and wives in the cotton weaving district. If married women weavers' continuation at the mill after marriage is accounted for in terms of the combined impact of economic need and personal inclination, then husbands' concurrence with their wives' desires appears even more significant in indicating a decisive shift in the gender distribution of power among weaving couples. To sum up, in the decades prior to the First World War, the Lancashire cotton industry, while maintaining its prominent position within the British economy, came under increasing pressure from international competition. In order to maintain its dominant position, which depended on exports rather than the domestic market, the quality of the input at each stage of the process was reduced while machinery was speeded up. Nevertheless, workers continued to be expected to produce goods of high quality. It was the level of skill that enabled workers to do so, including the women who predominated in the weaving workforce. awareness of their skill, which manifested itself in commensurate earnings and took a long time to acquire, was marked among female weavers, who appropriated the discourse of the skilled worker, usually thought of as male. These women identified as skilled workers first, as wives and mothers second. Their self-conception was embedded in and acted upon the understanding of gender characteristic of the heartland of cotton weaving. Given the inability of any weaving family to subsist on the earnings of one adult alone, the notion of male breadwinner and its concomitant, the domestic housewife, had no currency. Instead, women were expected to make a vital contribution to family income by striving to attain a high level of skill at weaving and to continue at the mill at least until their wages could be substituted by those of their teenage children. In light of the benefits brought to their families by women's employment, relations of gender in the family became more egalitarian. Husbands took over a number of household chores and, even more significantly, fully cooperated with their wives in spacing the births of their children so that they would not interfere with wives' employment in the factory. Around the cotton weaving industry, which monopolised local labour markets in the heartland of weaving, they developed a specific working class culture whose notions of gender differed markedly from the discourse of the labour movement at national level. The understanding of femininity comprised the legitimacy, indeed the requirement, of paid employment away from home, even for mothers of families, the expectation that women workers achieve a high level of skill, and the recognition of the important contribution female earnings made to family income. Together with the corresponding notion of masculinity, these understandings of gender made for more egalitarian relations between men and women than elsewhere in the British working class. Thank you very much.